I am just back from a couple of weeks in Bhutan, which is a small country nestled between India and China. It's small, it's about the size of Switzerland. And it is, as some of you may know, it's a Buddhist country. Buddhist, the national religion of Bhutan is Vajrayana Buddhism. And Vajrayana Buddhism is what many of us in the West know of as Tibetan Buddhism. And actually, Bhutan and Tibet are very close. They bump up right against each other. So it was extraordinarily, it was a big trip. Perhaps like some of you, but maybe even more extreme in some ways, I did almost nothing during the last 3 years of the pandemic. I barely left the house. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but not totally. And so I was invited to go on this 20-hour plane ride journey with a group, an organization that I've been on the board of, but I've actually never met any of the people in real life. I had only known them over Zoom. And somehow I thought it would be a good idea to just take off and go on this trip. So I did. And I'm so glad that I did, because it has left me very much in a state of feeling relit, quite inspired. So what I'm going to do this evening is share with you. I'm going to share my screen in a moment, and with deep bows to Johnny, who was very patiently walked me through the process of how to put together a slide presentation. I'm gonna talk to you about my trip with some props. So I will be sharing photographs and also, God willing, some sounds from my trip. So let me try. I'm gonna share my screen. I'm going to pick the thing, share, and now I go to my slideshow. Bear with me. And play. Okay, I can't see you anymore, but I hope that you see a slide which says Bhutan, Land of the Thunder Dragon. Oh, Grover. Nope, that would not be a good thing to do right now. I'm doing a slideshow. Quiet. Okay, I can't see you to know if you're seeing this, but I'm going to assume that you are. So, as with many countries, Bhutan has a national bird. But the national bird of Bhutan is not an eagle or a hawk, but a dragon, which perhaps begins to give you a flavor of the place. It's a country in which the human and the mythic or magical realms of reality are very fluid. The line between them is very, very thin. And you'll get a better sense of this, I hope, as we go along. So, as I said, it is a country that's nestled in the Himalayas, in the deep mountains. And it is rooted very, very deeply in spiritual life in a way that this country, our country here, is not. And I'm not assuming that everyone who's on this call is from the United States. But this is was for me, it was really a very radical reorientation. to be in a place where that wasn't didn't have the underpinnings of capitalism, where commerce and money and wealth were not are not the driving principles. And in some ways, I could feel bumping up against a place where that wasn't the case, how kind of familiarized I become, how immune, how, what's the right word? It's just sort of the air I have been breathing. And I didn't really get that there's a whole different possibility. Some of you may be aware that Bhutan is sometimes referred to or talked about in terms of having this bottom line of gross national happiness rather than gross national product. And gross national happiness includes the happiness of the people. It includes the happiness of the place, the environment, and the happiness of the culture itself. And this photo here is of a Dzong, Zhan, which is what you see all throughout Bhutan. A Dzong is a temple. And the temples are really, they're kind of like the skyscrapers of New York or San Francisco or any big city. They are the key buildings, the most central part of the country itself. And one of the other things you may not know about Bhutan, in addition to this kind of cultural idea of happiness, is that Bhutan has also s maintained 72% of the country as forest. So, not built on, not cut down. It's a carbon negative country, which means it gives off less carbon than the country itself absorbs. So, there's a whole element of really deeply understanding the interconnectedness between human beings and the natural world and the planet. And on the trip that I was on, we traveled to a quite remote part of Bhutan. I've been there before. I was there 5 years ago. And this time I went to places that I definitely had never been. It was a 10-hour trip across two big mountain passes on roads that someone said, there's no such thing as a straight road in Bhutan. And at the top of the mountain passes, there's a tradition of hanging these prayer flags. And the flags themselves, as you may have seen here, they're here you may have seen them in Tibetan temples as well. They're prayers, they're flags with prayers on them that are sent out in the wind. And every mountaintop, every mountain pass, the top of every mountain, there's just hundreds and hundreds of these prayer flags that are strung up. And so we too did our share of getting out of the van in the freezing cold and tromping around and hanging up these prayer flags. And one of the places that we went on this journey was to a little town, actually a village called Buli, Buli. And this is a photograph of Buli from the hillside. And it is stunningly beautiful place that is just was brimming with pride, the people who live there. And you can see the white flags in the front of this photograph are also prayer flags that are kind of propped. You can see some in the front here. And if you look at the very top on the right, you can see an additional set of prayer flags. And while we were there, someone asked the question, I think I have, there it is, the title. Somebody asked the question, well, how did this little village come to be in this spot? Because Buli is the furthest. There's nothing past Buli. Once you get to Buli, then it's just wilderness beyond. And you can kind of see what you're looking into, the mountains behind. And so, how did this little village come to be, and how does it support itself? Really was the question that was asked from kind of a Western mind. And the answer is something that I've been chewing on for some time, which is I would have thought the answer might be something like, well, there's a river that allows, trade to happen up and down, or there's some kind of ability to grow things, or there is some kind of natural resource, something like that, that would cause this village, which is thousands of years old, to come and sustain itself. But no, that's not the story of Buli. The story of Buli is very much a kind of microcosm of the whole mindset, mind and heart set, if you will, of the Bhutanese, which is that thousands of years ago, someone, I don't know if it was a human or a deva, had a dream or a vision of this place. And as a result of that dream or vision, and then setting out to find this place, they created a temple. Actually, I'll skip forward. This is the temple that was built in response to the vision. And in the temple, there was a teacher. And that teacher, as a result of the temple and the teacher, this village grew up around. And I'll go back so you can see this is a example of one of the houses in Buli, and this is one of the pathways where we walked side by side with the cows. And so while we were there, we went to visit this temple, and we were told actually that we might be, as visitors to this temple, the first white people who had ever come to visit this temple. That's how remote this place is. And on the outside of the temple, you can see at the doorway there are some prayer wheels, but all along the backside of the temple, there's this line of prayer wheels. And like prayer flags, prayer wheels are meant to be spun, and when you spin them, as I had the opportunity to do here, you send the prayers into the world, into the universe. So they let us inside this temple, and you can get just a feel for the kind of raucous color and beauty and festivity, right? This is not a somber temple. This is a place that is full of life. And in the In the corner there, there was kind of a secret shrine room that they let us into, which has this image. This is Kalima, who is a great, you see these images all throughout Bhutan, these fierce deities, these protector deities. And so there's no fear of this kind of fierce quality of our nature, of our being. That maybe, that can be, that in many ways is so essential to taking care of what we care about, of protecting, of preserving, of caring for life, of caring for the environment, of caring for children, animals, and caring for the teachings. So, a little bit of backdrop. The whole of this trip that I was on, including this trip to the village of Buli, was the vision of this guy, Dorji Wangchuck. And Wangchuck is a last name in Bhutanese that's kind of like Smith. There are many, many Wangchucks. But this Dorji Wangchuck is, he is also on the board of the organization that I'm part of. And he, for some time, had been talking to us about his teacher, his Bhutanese teacher. And he, like many people in the culture, had a very full, what we might call a lay life. He's an amazing guy. He speaks six languages. He has three PhDs. He was the press secretary to the king of Bhutan, which is a kingdom. And he was the person responsible in 1999 for bringing television for the very first time. 1999, just 23 years ago, bringing television into Bhutan, and to do that in a way that was careful, as in caring, to bring television in a way that supported access to the outside world without the kind of harm that this kind of media can bring. So this trip that we took, this 10-hour journey over two mountain passes, over windy roads, the trip to Buli to visit this very far out village, all of this was Dorji's planning. And really the heart of the trip was taking this small group of us to visit his teacher, whose name, a different kind of Dorji, Dorji Phagmo. Just take a look at her image if you are able. Dorji Phagmo is the only female Rinpoche in all of Bhutan. And I'm going to read to you a little bit about her so you get a flavor. A Rinpoche in the Vajrayana tradition is understood as someone who's a reincarnate. So she's understood to have been, there have been many, many Dorji Phagmos over thousands of years. And it's said that when she was born, that there were kind of miracles that happened, that her birth was welcomed, it says, by rainbows encircling the sun and illuminating the spot where her birth took place. And at her birth, she was found to have these interesting birthmarks and imprints that clearly were special, but people weren't quite sure what they were. And actually, the story is that because of these imprints and birthmarks on her body, the villagers were frightened and thought, uh-oh, maybe she's some kind of this little baby, some kind of a witch or an evil spirit. But fortunately for her, her grandfather took a very strong stand and said, no, he came to her defense. And as she grew up, this little baby who became a child performed miracles. And as a result of this, the villagers in the town started to kind of calm down. And at some point, she was fortunate to have a visitation with the king. And the king recognized her and recognized the markings on her body as Dorji Phagmo. So she was recognized as this reincarnation. And so as a result of that, she set out to go and visit with a teacher. And the teacher had had in this monastery, had had a vision that Dorji Phagmo was coming. And everyone set up a big ceremony for Dorji Phagmo. And then they were stunned to discover basically, you know, a one-year-old. She was somewhere between 1 and 2 years old, this little child who was Dorji Phagmo. They were expecting more of an adult. Anyhow, as a result of all of that, She did extensive training in Buddhist teaching and eventually came to where she is now in this remote part of Jamgang, it's called, in eastern Tibet, in eastern Bhutan, where she established this. It's a monastery, but it's a not monastery, it's a nunnery. It's a monastery for young girls. And this is one of the main buildings here. This is the left-hand door is the dining room, and the right-hand door is the kitchen. And here's an image of some of the girls, some of the nuns who we hung out with. And I'll show you just some additional images of the girls and the dogs. And many of them are very young, but there were a few. You see the image on the left is one of the older nuns who I watched so often. And she would stroll back and forth along the road and the path, turning her prayer wheel there that's in her right hand on our left, and clicking her prayer beads and chanting back and forth, back and forth. And on the right, you see one of the young nuns. And it's an interesting thing because really, a nunnery in Bhutan is more or less an orphanage. And so many, if not all, of these young girls were deposited here under Dorji Phagmo's care out of very difficult circumstances. And I didn't learn all of the stories, but in some cases they had parents who were sick or died. In some cases they were impoverished. And in some cases had either mental or physical disability of some kind. And so they landed in this nunnery where just this extraordinary care was, you could just feel it in everything that happened. You could feel it in the way that the older nuns took care of the younger nuns. You could hear it in the laughter among the girls who were there. And the heart of their life was practice. And this is an image here of the nuns walking up the hill to this stupa. And here's the stupa. And a stupa is a statue inside of which there are all kinds of holy relics. And this statue, I mean, sorry, the stupa was very much the handiwork of the Dorji Wangchuck who brought us here. He more or less single-handedly insisted that this stupa would be built because they started to build it and then the pandemic happened and everything shut down. And he basically said, well, if no one else wants to join me, I'm going to build it myself. And he camped out here and ended up gathering some additional people around him to build this beautiful stupa that becomes kind of the centerpiece. It's sitting right next to the temple. And I will show you an image of these nuns, and I hope that you will be able to hear. So the practice that is done in the Vajrayana tradition in general, and at this nunnery in particular, is it looks and feels a little bit different than what some of us may be familiar with as practice, the practice of Buddhism or Buddhist teaching in the West. And most of the practice is a combination of chanting, sort of devotional chanting, which is what the nuns are doing here, circumambulating the stupa, which we had the really the privilege, the benefit of also being able to do. and then engaging in kind of ritual and ceremony. And part of Dorje Wangchuck's big plan was that he had us drive these 10 hours, treacherous over windy roads, because he really wanted us to get to this monastery on the night of the full moon, or for the night of the full moon, when there was going to be a ceremony for Green Tara. Tara is the bodhisattva of great compassion. And Green Tara, in particular, is the emanation or the version of Tara, this compassionate figure who is engaged in the world. And this image that you see here of Green Tara is the statue that was in the main temple. And interestingly, Dorje Phagmo, the person, is understood to be the fierce emanation, this is her image here, of Green Tara. So it was very interesting because this fierce version of Green Tara felt so different from this kind of very earth mother grounded figure of the Dorje Phagmo who we met and spent time with, the reincarnate Rinpoche who we spent time with. And yet, clearly, her dedication to the teaching, her dedication to caring for these young girls was required a kind of fierceness that was blended with her care, her deep, deep care and compassion. We had an opportunity to meet with the living Dorje Phagmo, and she did a blessing ceremony for us. And then we were able to ask her questions. And it was so striking, her quality of humanness, her quality of humanity. And so often she would answer questions when people would say, you know, I have this difficulty or that difficulty, and what should I do? And she would say, oh, yeah, I struggle with that too. And this is a woman who, you know, famous teachers from all over Bhutan come to this remote location to receive her blessings. And it's said that she continues to have miracles occur around her, like imprints of her hand that or her foot in stones and rainbows and things like that. And on this day, we spent a full day in this ceremony. I'll show you a clip, you'll get to listen. A ceremonial day of tribute to both Green Tara and Dorje Phagmo. And that night, we were all seated around a campfire and looked up behind us in the sky, and there was the full moon, and it was also an eclipse of the moon. So we saw this giant moon in the sky and then watched the shadow of the eclipse pass over. All of which is considered to be extremely auspicious. And for me, I found that sitting in the temple, and I'll show you this, and you'll get to hear for hours and hours. It was very different from sitting in silent meditation. And yet, just enormously transformational. I felt myself as I sat there hour after hour, feeling and listening and hearing the sounds, just the vibratory impact on my body. I felt places in my body and my heart, particularly, that just kind of unwound and opened. So I'll give you a little taste of this. So, just to give you a sense that as much as we may come to love and cherish, as I do, the possibility of sitting in silence, to recognize that there are many forms of practice, and that this kind of devotional and ceremonial practice has its own wisdom, has its own heart. And for me, I sat in a seat next to this young girl who I see her now, and it's just there's something in her face, in her beauty, in the light in her eyes that is quite powerful and beautiful, and serves as a reminder, served and continues to serve for me as a reminder of what's possible for us. So I want to share a few final slides from the monastery. On the last day that we were there, I stayed for 4 nights. In quite rugged circumstances. So I had a roommate, and we stayed in a room on something that somebody might call a bed, but it was not exactly a mattress. They were very, very hard surfaces that I ended up putting some blankets on top of because my bones literally hurt from sleeping. And my roommate and I would wake up in the morning, and both of us would be like, oh, because it kind of hurt everywhere when we got up. And we would wake up with these like aching everywhere, and then just start laughing because there was something about this place that was so alive and so spirited in a way, so full of joy, despite the lack of mattress, despite the pit toilets that were in the room right next door to our bedroom that smelled terrible, despite the showers, if you could call them that, that we took that were created by boiling of hot water in these big metal containers, and then were given to us that we mixed the hot water with the cold water and just poured it over our heads to clean ourselves up. And again, it was, I said to many people, if I had known from the mind that I left California with, what I was headed into, that I was going to be on 10 hours of windy roads, that I was going to be sleeping on a hard bed with a pit toilet and, no real showers and, not very good food and I probably wouldn't have gone. But I am so glad that I did, because it reminded me once again that there's more to being alive than being comfortable. So on this last day of our time at this Dorje Phagmo's monastery, nunnery, it turned out that it was the birthday of the king. And so any occasion for celebration was occasion for celebration. And so they put up this happy birthday to the king and lit all these butter lamps, and they gave the nuns these happy birthday glasses that they handed out in celebration. And so my hope is that by sharing these and the other photos and so on, that you can get a sense of the joy and the beauty, really, of this place, where all of these young women who, this is a picture of the shoes outside the dining room, all of these young women were deposited and loved, deposited and cared for in this extraordinary way. So I'm gonna hope that yes, you can see it. That's what I wanted. That was very funny. I was watching the slideshow, but I had no way of knowing if you could see it. So I see. Thank you for your messages that you could see the slides. And let's just see if there's anything else that I want to say. Well, I hope from my words and the images and how happy you can see my dog as he was flipped over, being happy, and some of the sounds of the place, that I can share a little bit of the beauty and the impact of this journey. And I'm going to stop here and invite you to raise a hand if you like. And if you have a question, if you have a comment, if there's probably more things that you may want to know about Bhutan or the place that I traveled, and I'll do my best to answer. I think easiest, if you can do it, to hit the raise hand button at the bottom, because that will pop you up to the top of the screen and will make it easy for me to respond and Johnny to kind of co-highlight you so we can have some conversation. So anyone have a question or a reflection or anything that you felt or were impacted by, you're welcome to raise a hand. Yeah, Luisa.
Hi, that was so beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing this amazing journey with us. It's funny that you say if you knew the circumstances, you wouldn't have gone. And it's such a big reminder for me that there's more to life than being comfortable. So thank you for that, highlighting. And I was just curious, where were the young men? Like, if that was a nunnery, was there any boys that were orphans? Or so that's what.
There are nunneries and monasteries. So
Gotcha.
the young boys would go off to the monastery and have their own training. As is often the case, and I think was true here, in general, the circumstances for the women are less positive than circumstances for the young men. And I have visited some of the monasteries the last time I was in Bhutan, and actually one of the guides, who was one of Dorji Wangchuck's friends, Nim, his son was recognized as a reincarnate, as a Rinpoche, and he is off living at a monastery that part of the group, not part of the part that I was participating with, went and stayed at that monastery as well. So it's understood that any young person who asks to go to a monastery or a nunnery can go. I mean, they have to negotiate with their parents, obviously. But I think in particular for the young women, that this place, it was clearly known that many of the young women who were there were not there just out of spiritual aspiration. They were there out of hardship. And there were young girls who clearly had physical disability. There were wheelchairs and crutches, and there were clearly some who had some kind of cognitive or mental disability. And yet they were all taken in, you know. And one of the stories that I heard from someone else who was there, not directly from Dorji Phagmo herself, was that she took as a practice having her meals with the other young girls. And the reason that she did that was because she knew that because of her status, that she would receive good food. And she knew that if she didn't eat with the young girls, that they would not receive good food. And so that was part of her act of compassion, was to engage in that way to help support them, which I felt just so moving, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really sweet. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. You're welcome. Thanks. Anyone else? A question, a reflection, a comment? Yeah, Nancy. Let me unmute you. There you go.
Okay. Yeah. So thank you so much for sharing. That was remarkable and powerful. I wanted you to speak more about the sound experience with the music. Was that actually a form of meditation, or is that just the state you got into?
I think that the sounds were very much a meditative experience. So both the sounds that you heard of the nuns chanting as they circumambulated the stupa, then there were the kind of cacophonous sounds that you heard in the ceremonies. And then all day long, you would hear, you know, in the dining room, there was chanting. As they walked along, there was chanting. So, and the chanting wasn't random. They're chanting prayers, right? And so, yeah, that was very much a part of the practice. And for me, it was, again, it was a very helpful reminder that we can become very precious about needing our silence, you know. And of course, there's a place for silence, you know. I love being in silence and being on silent retreat, but it's not the only practice. And I discovered and actually had the direct experience of sitting in the middle of this kind of ceremonial chanting hour after hour and feeling tremendous impact in my heart, in my body, in a way that felt similar, though obviously through a different door, to things I might have experienced from after hour of sitting in silence. So that was very expansive in a way for me to go, oh, right, there are lots of different ways in, right? Somebody asked me, well, do the nuns, do they sit? You know, do they do silent meditation? And I thought, no, they don't. That's not their practice. But are they practicing? Absolutely, all the time. They're walking, they're playing instruments, they're chanting, they're reciting, they're caring for each other. All of that is part of the practice. Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Anyone else? Looks like Michael and then Virgil.
Hi. Thanks, Pam. This is amazing and so beautiful to learn about. I was curious if your friend sort of talked at all about this process of like bringing like video entertainment or media into the country and sort of like how that went. You know, was it sort of like successful? Were they able to sort of keep it controlled in such a way that it doesn't sort of take the shape that, you know, we kind of have the experience of here?
Yeah, I think that the initial experiment of bringing television into the country in a very limited way was actually fairly successful. It's different now because of cell phones and social media. And that, I think, has had a big and, you know, not entirely positive impact, I would say. And I mean, I think it's important to say that Bhutan, for all of its, you know, fame of gross national happiness and, you know, being a carbon negative country and so on, it's not a paradise. You know, it has all kinds of trouble. And some of those troubles, I think, have very much been escalated by not so much television, but social media. And once younger people start to see what looks like yummy things out there, and especially because there is a lot of physical hardship. You know, I spent 4 days on a hard mattress with a pit toilet. But I'm not living that way every day. It's one of the few places that is relatively protected. They only let a certain number of tourists in every year. You can't go there by yourself. You have to be part of a guided tour, which isn't so much because they don't want you to see things, but they're trying to protect the country, you know, from being trampled on in a way. And so it's in a precarious place, I think, that the country and the place and the culture. So it's part of why, for me, being able to go and see and be impacted and then share some of that feels really important, because the reorientation for us of remembering, like, oh, right, you know, the first night I got to a place that was outside the nunnery, you know, which was a hotel in the mountains, still in Bhutan, I sent a note to the woman who had been my roommate, who went in a different direction, and I said, oh my God, you know, it's like, OMG, a mattress. So yeah, I appreciated having a mattress and a shower, you know, those were great things. But we gain something and we lose something, right? In both ways. Yeah.
Thank you. Your comment about comfort not being everything really resonates, and I think it's gonna stick a little bit.
Yeah, it was very interesting for me because I stayed in a fancy hotel in Bangkok, which was where I flew to initially before flying to Bhutan. And it was a fancy Thai hotel. And when I first got there, before I went to Bhutan, I was like, this is really nice. So, you know, I was exhausted from jet lag and so on. And then I stayed there again a few days after being in Bhutan. And it had definitely lost a bit of its luster. You know, it was so nice and all, I mean, the people were wonderful and the everything was fancy and there's a spa and there's a swimming pool and there's, and on one level it was great, but I could feel what wasn't there. You know, that connection with life in the world that brings itself forward in a more rugged but deeply spiritual set of circumstances, I could feel the absence of that on my way home. So, yeah. Thank you. I think we have one more. Is it Virgil? That's what it says on your...
Hi. It's two of us. And we have spent a lot of time traveling in Buddhist parts of Asia. And I just wanted to comment that no matter which country or which branch of Buddhism, it's the monks and the monks in training who get all the community support, and the poor little nuns have to pretty much thrive on their own.
Yeah,
we went to Myanmar with Temple Smith a few years ago, and we went on alms rounds with the monks, and then we visited a nunnery, and we took all kinds of school supplies and craft supplies and personal care supplies to the nunnery because they just don't have them.
Yeah. Well, that was part of the not Dorje Phagmo, but Dorje Wangchuck. That was part of his intention, was to bring us to see this so that we would bring more support. And one of the things that happened for me personally was a sort of spontaneous pledge with the woman who was my roommate there, an offer to, for not a lot of money, we promised them that we would supply all of their robes on an annual basis for all.
Wonderful.
And this is, it's so important that we recognize and support the women practitioners who are, you know, often consistently, as you're describing, sort of second class citizens, you know.
Except in Mongolia. In Mongolia, the nuns even marry and have families, and they have chosen not to be the orphanages because they want to feel a sense of pride and feel respect from the community. So it's a different outlook.
Maybe that's the next trip to Mongolia. Yeah. I remember when I was living in the monastery as a monk, when I was a student, and we had a visiting a woman from Japan who came to stay, and it was a Zen monastery where I was living. And somebody asked her, what's the difference between, you know, practicing in Japan and practicing here? I was at Tassajara Zen Mountain Monastery, and she did this motion with her hands, and she said, in America, monks and nuns like this. In Japan, and I feel like for me that planted a seed, you know, decades ago, that has sort of just been fueled over time to increasingly want to support the women practitioners, because well, maybe not in Mongolia, but in most places, what you're describing and what I saw as well is true. Yeah. So we're at time. Thank you both for your share. And thank you. I got muted. I'm going to do just a brief dedication, and then we can, if you'd like to stay on, and we'll unmute you and you can say hello. But just taking a moment to feel any any goodness, any inspiration, anything that may have touched your mind or heart or body in the teachings offered this evening. Really breathing it all in, letting yourself be nourished and supported. And then sending it all out, sharing, offering any goodness, any benefit that may have come from our gathering together this evening, offering it with open hands and open hearts for the benefit, the well-being, the freedom, the peace of all beings everywhere. By the power and truth of our practice together, may we, together with all beings, awaken and be free. Thank you all very much for your kind attention, and I will look forward to seeing you again. You are welcome all to unmute. Say hello to one another if you have.
Thank you, Pam.
Thank you. So beautiful.
Thank you, Pam.
Thank you so much.
Beautiful.
Better.
Amazing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for sharing.
Beautiful.
Representing.
Oh my gosh.
Representing white people.
Thank
well.
Thank you.
It was quite a delight to get to go, and really happy that I could share it with all of you. So.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.